Welcome to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. What did George Washington do that you might not know about? What did Abe Lincoln know that could change the way you think about the Civil War? You'll learn about all that and more on this special show designed to restore excitement in American history. Let's get started. Hello, and welcome to the Grateful American Radio Show. Today, Kate McGinnis Wyatt takes us on a journey through hallowed ground. In fact, bringing visitors to the hallowed ground where the founding fathers and mothers lived, and all the way up through the Civil War and beyond, of course, is the focus of most of the Grateful American series. So it is a pleasure to be here today with Kate, founder and president of the Journey Through Hallowed Ground Partnership. Hello, and thank you for having us in your headquarters.
Well, I am thrilled that you and David are here. Thank you for coming and visiting us here in Waterford.
It is a pleasure. So David Bruce Smith and I are here today, and we are in Waterford, Virginia, which is this amazing little hamlet tucked away. You'd have to want to come here. There's a festival every year that was just a week or so ago.
That's right.
But this is a little slice of heaven, a little slice of the past.
Well, we love it here. It's a beautiful place founded by Quakers and looks very much today the way it did when they built it. And the entire village is a National Historic Landmark as well.
Fascinating. And we'll get all into that. But let's tell our readers and our listeners a little bit about what your project is focused on. So this is a national heritage area which runs from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, through Maryland and West Virginia, to Thomas Jefferson's Monticello in Charlottesville. The historical land, stretching 180 miles long and 75 miles wide, includes 9 presidential homes and birthplaces, more than 10,000 sites on the National Register of Historic Places, and sites from the Revolutionary War, French Indian War, War of 1812, and the Civil War. This historic region is also home to not only beautiful homes, charming towns, and battlefields, but also 13 of the nation's 400 national parks. So really, this is just an amazing, breathtaking, historical place. And so our first question for you is that since 2005, your nonprofit, which is a 4-state partnership, has been dedicated to raising awareness of the unparalleled American heritage in the region. So tell us about this project that you've been running for all this time.
Well, it's called the Journey Through Hallowed Ground Partnership. Each one of those words actually has a very significant meaning in our mission. And the backstory is that I had been living and working in London, Moscow, Kazakhstan, and returned to this region to a little house here in Waterford where we chose to raise our children. And in returning, I had what I call my Dorothy moment. You know, there's no place like home. Well, there's no place like this stretch of ground from Gettysburg to Monticello in the country or in the world. And yet in returning, I was shocked to find that there was a casino being planned up in Gettysburg, townhouses being planned by overlooking Thomas Jefferson's home on Mount Alto, which is literally part of his original estate. The site of the largest cavalry battle in the history of North America at Brandy Station was being planned for a multi-million square foot mall. And it struck me that we were taking all, and I just don't mean the places and the bricks and the mortar, but more importantly, the stories of the individuals for granted, the folks who made this country strong, the folks who defended the ideals of democracy, the folks who were tested, folks like you and me, not just, you know, the 9 presidents who lived here and the leaders like John Marshall. It's really was rather simple to see that we could carve this region out, and if we could create a business plan and bring it to every town and county and engage every Main Street community and the historic homes and the equestrian agrarian community, which allows the cultural fabric of this landscape to stay together, then we would have a fighting chance of doing the right thing by honoring the history here. Because at the same time, it would also support the quality of life of all the citizens here. And finally, increase the fiscal bottom line of each of the communities here, because tourism was their number one industry. But visitation to every site was trending downwards. So by rebranding the area and creating this nonprofit and engaging folks and allowing everyone to be part of creating this National Heritage Area, we did set out in 2005 with a very ambitious business plan. And I'm pleased to report that we have met or exceeded each of our objectives since that time.
And I think we need to give a little bit of context to let our listeners know exactly how powerful you are as a businesswoman. After being the youngest vice president within both Xerox Realty and Weston Capital Corporation, you left the private sector to serve in the public sector as the Secretary of Commerce and Trade for the Commonwealth of Virginia within Governor Wilder's cabinet. You were later appointed to the co-chair of the Defense Conversion Commission with General John Lowe. And after serving in the cabinet, you created Remington International, and in this capacity, created businesses in London, Moscow, and Kazakhstan. But then you took a leave of absence to create the Journey Through Hallowed Ground Partnership. So tell us, what made you take that leap?
A lot of good friends pushed me over the edge, I guess. There were a lot of people, as I mentioned, working tirelessly to raise awareness of the history, the historic, cultural, and natural resources in this swath of land. Chris Miller from the PEC, Dick Moe at the National Trust, Jim Lighthizer from the Civil War Trust, onwards. I mean, the superintendents of the 13 national parks, the directors of historic homes, whether it was Oatlands or George Marshall's home, everyone was working so hard. And it was at the time, you know, almost considered fait accompli that every single development would be permitted. And I, having been a developer, knew I could also talk to the developers and to the farmers and to the elected officials, having worked with so many. So in short, it wasn't so much a leap as it was a beautiful confluence of years of working with a lot of different people, a trust that had built up over all those years of working together, and the recognition that nobody intentionally desecrates our history. The developers weren't the enemy and they weren't the problem. It was simply that nobody had said, hey, wait a minute, let's take a couple steps back and take a longer view on this site. Let's think about what the alternatives are. A casino by nature is not wrong. Let's just move it on down the road. It doesn't have to be right on the battlefield. Townhouses aren't bad, but overlooking Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, not the best place. You know, let's move it on down the road. So it's just a matter of working collaboratively with a whole lot of folks who were so talented that when I say they pushed me over, I mean that made it easy to run off with a parachute.
Okay, but still, to get this huge swath of land, 180 miles by 75, under easement.
Not terribly. It won't be under easement. What we're doing is raising, and I don't mean to interrupt, but just for clarification, we won't ease all the land, and we don't even want regulatory control. What we want is informed decision-making.
Okay, so to get it protected, would you call it that?
To have appropriate growth, a growth that respects our history, a growth that doesn't desecrate our past in the name of just simple progress, growth that allows for a continued economic engine through heritage tourism and recreational tourism. It was just switching the lens through which people saw what the future possibilities of this landscape could be is really what we have been able to bring to the market.
Okay, so two questions. Was and is there resistance to this idea? And you have this four-state area now, but how did you define the border? I mean, it could have been, Ohio was also the birthplace of a few presidents. Mm-hmm. Why is it that you it went West Virginia, Pennsylvania?
Right. That's a really good question. And I'll tell you, it was with an extraordinary amount of research and forethought, because in drawing the lines around this region, what I knew for sure was that the visitor experience would have to be authentic. If the economic engine behind this is really to invite people to come to visit, whether it's for the historic, the natural, or the cultural attractions, it had to be authentic. It couldn't be ginned up, and we couldn't be everything to everybody. So in doing the research, what we found is that any further north of Gettysburg or west of the ridgeline along the Appalachian Trail, what you had was a completely different culture of the valley and the Germans who settled there, a very strong and rich history, a very different cultural history than once you came over the Appalachian Trail and then down to the coastal plain. And once you hit that mark where you just meet the coastal plain, anything further east in the coastal plain had, again, a very different history and heritage and geological structures, so that the natural and the cultural resources were quite different. And so we drew the lines that and used, on the eastern side in particular, a lot of the where the Native Americans actually would ford the rivers, because you could see where the coastal plain would meet the Piedmont. And within the Piedmont, what you found was three overarching themes that held this region from Gettysburg to Monticello together. When we pulled every file from the National Register of Historic Places to actually find out what happened here, and it took a year, because I didn't want to kid ourselves. And then we took those records, some of which had never been opened for the 30 years they've been in there. We sent them back to the historic site for validation, to say, is this place still intact? Is there more history to tell about it than what was written 30 years ago? That updated information was then sent to each of the state historic preservation officers in the four states for validation and for any edits or additions. Those reports then, and mind you, there's something like 9,317 of these structures within Virginia alone. That information on each site then went back to the keeper of the records. And did you know that America actually has an official titled position called the Keeper of the Records? She's a wonderful woman, but I always thought it was slightly Monty Python-ish, you know, the Keeper of the Records. But with that information, we were able to establish and validate this region as it hung together in its history. I will tell you, David, though, I had a congressman who represented the region from the southern part of this, Albemarle County, all the way down to South Boston, who said, in doing this, we realized we wanted to have an act of Congress to designate this region a national heritage area. So I went to members of Congress early days and asked them if we could count on their support. Well, this particular congressman said, you can count on my support as long as you pull the whole region all the way down through my congressional district to the North Carolina border. Because he saw the benefit of this type of collaborative working relationship. And I said, I'm sorry, sir, but that vote is too expensive. We can't please everybody.
Right.
That's a different culture. If you want me to help you create a national heritage area down there that shares the rich culture and history there, fine, but we're not going to dilute the enormity of our mission and the extensive amount of research we've done just for a vote in Congress. And the same happened in the North. They wanted us to take it up to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and it wouldn't hang together.
So, all right, so in this Gettysburg to Monticello swath, is it fair to say that you have fertilized the interest in American history? And if so, how has visitorship been affected at the Founding Father homes and or other homes since 2005?
We have been, I will tell you that it's not so much that we had to fertilize, because people were, I did a voter survey, public opinion poll before starting this. Because while I thought it was a pretty neat idea to create this, not to really aggressively go after rebranding this region and as where America happened, and then be able to share it and market it to bring in visitors, I wanted to know if the citizens felt the same way. I was blown away. So many people were so proud of the history and the culture in their own backyard. So many groups were working so hard to raise to local and national attention, you know, whether it was an abandoned Freeman's home or the graffiti house, which was down in Culpeper, which was used as a Civil War hospital after the Battle of Brandy Station, or whether it was even some of our national parks who were struggling to have greater national recognition. So I didn't have to fertilize anything, but what we were able to do by bringing everybody together was really heighten the awareness. So to answer your question, there was already fertile territory and fertile interest in bringing to greater attention these remarkable sites. The beauty of it, to get to the second part of your question about visitation, we have the data on visitation in each of the counties in each of the four states. And we have been able to show that visitation has steadily increased. Now, mind you, 2005, you know, everybody was having a tough time because it was shortly after, you know, 9/11 and a few other things. And we have tons of anecdotal information. You know, everybody saying, oh, I saw people coming in with the maps and they want to know more about the journey, or the travel guidebook is what draw them there. They talked about the website and how interesting it was. But so we do know that visitation in all of our partnering sites has gone up. And it's the the presidential homes that are open to the public, the Monticello, the Montpeliers, certainly Ashland Highland, the 13 national parks. They don't keep direct count on visitors, but we keep a count on visitor spending, which helps us with that data.
So do you think interest in history among kids is on the rise?
Sadly, I don't think so. But I'll tell you one thing back to the visitation, particularly family travel. We did do extensive research into who is the heritage tourist. And what we found was that there are usually two income earning families, highly educated. They spend more, they stay longer, but they have absolutely no time to plan a vacation. What they'll do is what I call the cruise ship mentality. They make the decision, am I going to take a Smithsonian tour or am I going to take a tour with the National Trust? Because they know it's a branded experience. They write one check and then they don't have to do all the detailing in the planning. So a lot of what we've done and what we're seeing some success in is making it easy for people to come. We plan itineraries. We have the travel guides. We have the website that allows you to build your interest geographically based on what your interest is. Is it presidential? Is it Civil War? Is it Revolutionary War? Is it historic Main Street communities? Is it archaeological sites? So that has made it easier for families and younger students to come.
Because I thought you were about to say something different from what Hope and I have been hearing based on your first answer. Visitorship is up, but interest in American history among kids isn't.
You know, they're not even teaching history in some school systems now. And since they don't test with the standards of learning history, there's a significant disincentive for teachers to spend much time teaching history. Having said that, I've had the pleasure and privilege of working with outstanding history teachers throughout the journey. And their frustration in having to teach to the test has been allayed by some really innovative collaborative programming that we've been able to work with them. And I don't know if you're interested in hearing about these programs, but what we have found is that if you allow students to learn history through inquiry-based analysis. In other words, don't tell them the dates and the facts, and don't have them memorize it and regurgitate it, and don't expect them to become engaged emotionally or even in a personal fashion with our shared history by reading a textbook. Quite the contrary. I mean, what we do is literally put the students in the boots of people who, in their own community, lived 100, 200, 50 years ago, and using only primary source documents, in other words, letters, maps, newspapers, diary entries, photographs, no textbooks, no Google, no Wikipedia allowed. These students assume the identities of these people. They have to face the facts that they did at that time. We don't tell them the end of the story. So the students have to decide what they would do under those circumstances. And then it's personal, and they'll never forget it. We introduce into this process high technology and creativity because we arm the students with lights, cameras, mini iPads, and all the Mac technology to turn this into a movie-making experience.
So it's three-dimensional.
It's three-dimensional. Where the students write the scripts, block the shots, they will actually make all the props. So if somebody can just sew, they're going to be in a major movie production. If somebody can just play piano, well, I say just, I wish I could just play piano, but if they just play piano, they could be scoring the music. If the students will act, edit, and their final six, we usually do six movies per entire class of sixth graders or seventh graders, become official National Park Service interpretive materials shown in the park for all visitors to come. And it's that particular type of learning is transformational.
Fantastic. And we'll definitely talk more and more about that in the coming months as we start to roll some of our stuff out too. So I think we have perfect collaboration here. But tell us about something else that's come to life, and it's this tribute to the 620,000 Americans who died during the Civil War, something called the Nonprofit Living Legacy Tree Planting Project, where you're going to plant 620,000 trees along the National Scenic Byway, commemorating the lost lives from both armies. So tell us more about that fabulous project.
Well, you know, I mentioned that we have 15 counties in the four-state region, and as many, actually, quite a few boroughs as well as town councils, all of whom passed resolutions to be part of the Journey Through Hollow Ground National Heritage Area and National Scenic Byway. Together, collaboratively, we sought congressional designation to become a National Heritage Area. Very competitive, very difficult. Together, collaboratively, we worked for 24 months with 60 community input sessions to think this Route 15 corridor, which is like the spine on the chapters of our history here, allows a visitor to go from top to bottom. And shouldn't that be a national scenic byway? Again, extremely competitive, as it should be, and rigorous. So that road was designated the 99th road in the entire country to be a national scenic byway. So fast forward a few years, and all the mayors in Virginia got a memo from the governor asking that they create a legacy project to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. Well, they all called me immediately and said, Kate, we don't want another monument. We don't want another flagpole. Isn't there something we can do all together that's bigger than anything any one of us could do alone? Just like when we got the National Heritage Area, just like when we got the National Scenic Byway. So my response was really quite simple. I said, of course, you know, if you think about it, Jefferson's Monticello is the southern terminus of our National Scenic Byway. He who wrote the words, all men are created equal, the words that were largely fought over during the Civil War. So as you turn out of his driveway and onto our National Scenic Byway, you travel 180 miles to Gettysburg. You pass the largest concentration of Civil War battlefields in the country, where most of the 620,000 men who died fought. So we're planting one tree for each of those men, 50% of which died anonymously, most of which never got a proper burial. So we thought it was appropriate that during the sesquicentennial, we should create the first national memorial to honor them. So the trees will be planted from Mr. Jefferson's driveway, and we will march them straight on up 180 miles, right to Gettysburg. We will geotag each tree with the name of the soldier, where he was born, where he died. Photographs and diary entries will be laid in so that for the first time, families can actually honor the fallen, and grieve for the loss. In the process, and I'm thrilled to share with you that both History Channel and Ancestry are corporate partners. So back to the point of engaging youth, we are working with teachers and students all over the country who are studying whom from their community fought and died. They're learning their stories, and then they're coming and they're planting trees. Mm-hmm. And these are the same middle school students who in 50 years' time will be our age, come the bicentennial. And they will take great pride in turning what was the bloodiest landscape in the country during the Civil War into the most beautiful landscaped LA. As it turns out, it will be the largest in the world by that time.
Are the trees of the period?
Do you know they are native? They are all native, so they would have been here then. And the primary palette is red buds for the show of color in the spring.
Right.
Red maples and red oaks for the show of color in the fall. Red cedars for the evergreens. And then red twig dogwood, which is a beautiful show of red in the winter.
I just want to veer off a little bit. I have a question. It's worth asking, but it's a little poetic license on my end. There were a lot of people, men, who walked the hallowed ground, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, James Madison. If you could pick any of those men, which of those men would you like to have been either a friend to or a wife to?
Oh, my. What a thought. So it's... Bachelor number one is Jefferson, yeah. Bachelor number two is Madison, and bachelor number three of the presidents who lived here.
It doesn't have to be a president.
Oh,
it
okay.
It could be Brown.
It could be John Brown. It could be Ike Eisenhower. It could be...
Well, not Eisenhower. He's too
contemporary.
Let's go Founding Fathers, Civil War.
Okay, Founding Fathers through the Civil War. Well, I would definitely Lincoln. Most definitely Lincoln. Lincoln... I would say, I mean, Jefferson, of course, is intriguing. Washington was reported to be quite a gentleman. But I would...
I'm going to change my question, not as a friend, because that's not really the question I want to ask. As a wife.
As a wife?
Who would you want to be married to?
Lincoln.
Why?
Oh, the breadth and depth of his thought process. The means with which he conveyed himself. He was humble and brilliant. He was... able to literally tilt the axis of the world because of his humility and his brilliance. And I think he was so witty, you know, had that wonderful way of easing tensions with humor.
If he had not been partially mythified into history because of the assassination, would you feel the same?
Oh, absolutely. Because I think we would have been a completely different country if he was able to lead us out of the war as he led us through it. He was not divisive. He saw the healing that needed to be done. Quite frankly, we would not have to be doing our Living Legacy tree planting program right now had Lincoln lived, because the families would have been able to honor their fallen brother, father, you know, their uncle, their grandfather. There would have been no dishonor in losing had Lincoln lived. His entire mission was to ensure that the citizens of the South would be welcomed back, that the survivors would not be shamed. But of course, that he never had the opportunity to see that vision come to fruition.
And maybe civil rights...
Oh,
would have ended earlier.
Much earlier. Much, much earlier. I mean, after his death, the divisiveness was intentional. It was malicious. And we're still feeling the effects to this day. I mean, it's interesting that you will probably get hate mail if people listen to this who disagree with me, because... You know, it was only a few years ago that the National Park Service was even able to officially say the Civil War was fought over slavery. Right. Because there were so many revisionists. I mean, when you're shamed in loss, you will find a reason to redefine what it was you were fighting for to begin with. And with that, then, you have a whole culture that builds up around that story to defend a position that may have been indefensible to begin with. So that's my fringe theory.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to talk about. Clearly, the Journey Through Hallowed Ground is a fantastic project, fascinating, encapsulating in just so many different facets. And we attribute that to your humility and your brilliance. So we thank you so much, Kate, for this wonderful tour of the Journey Through Hallowed Ground.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Come on back a lot more.
We definitely will. And we'll encourage many other people to come through.
Well, I sure do appreciate that. I do.
So definitely we'll give you all the information to check out Kate's website and lots of photos so that you can get a taste of it, so that when you come here, you'll know exactly where you want to go and what you want to see. That's it for today's episode of the Grateful American Radio Show. Stay tuned for more. You have been listening to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. Here's to restoring enthusiasm in history for kids and adults, too.